Chatter on Books. It's Cliff Notes for book clubs. Why read the book if you can listen to Chatter on Books? I'm Jamie McIntyre, your announcer, but you don't care about that. Here again is your host, Tori Clark.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to Chatter on Books. Hope everybody's doing well and staying healthy, and it is great to see everybody, including our Patreon patrons. Thanks for being with us. And in just a little bit, this is so great because people can see things. We're going to be talking to my friend, I can call her that, Sasha Payton Smith, about this fabulous book called The Witch Haven, which is murder and magic and mayhem in Manhattan. I couldn't think of any other M's. And it's really fabulous. And I'm a little insulted, Sasha, we'll come to you in a little bit, that it's a young adult book because I really liked it. joining us tonight, we got Claude Jennings doing all the important work and David Aldridge. And we have Ed Imar back with us, one of our Chatter on Books faves. And Ed, last time we saw you, welcome back. We were talking about The Unrepentant, which we loved. And since then, you did another book. Tell us about that. Tell us about what you've been up to.
Yeah, hi. Thank you so much for having me back. I wrote a book that came out, I guess, about a year and a half ago now.
November of 2020. Yeah.
A year ago. Okay. 20 years ago.
Yeah.
It came out, and that was called They're Gone. And I have an announcement coming up about a new book, potentially it maybe at the end of the month or so.
Awesome.
Cool.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. It's
okay, it's, you know, should we play charades? Is it a movie? Is it a book? Is it come on.
It's a book. It's a book. Okay. I didn't make a movie. But it's yeah, it's kind of exciting. You know, it's definitely the most me book I've ever written. So I feel really good about that. I don't, excellent. You know, yeah.
Excellent. Come back and talk to us about it.
I will. Thank you.
Okay. Hey, David. So if I'm watching anything on television on a Sunday morning, it's because I'm up watching Formula One, which doesn't happen every Sunday, but it happens a lot of Sundays now because I'm now addicted to Formula One because of that Netflix series. But Washington football, Sunday, NBC4, what are you doing?
Well, it's the latest iteration of a program that began in 1993.
Wow.
With the late, great George Michael here in D.C. George called me one day, and I had known George for many years. Obviously, I'd seen him. I was at the Post at the time, and he called and said he was doing a weekly show about the football team and wanted me to be on it. And I said, George, I just, you know, I don't want to be on it. I don't know. I mean, I just, I have so much to do. It's my first year on the beat, and I don't want to waste time. And then he told me how much he was going to pay me. And I went on the show.
It's amazing how that information can help. Isn't it?
Yeah, it helped out a lot. So I started the show with George and John Riggins and Sonny Jurgensen and had a blast and loved doing it for 2 years. And they've been, ever since, they've always had some show about the team every week. And this is the latest version.
Nice. What's the same? What's different?
Oh, everything's different. I mean, you know, back in those days.
Well, now the team sucks. There's that.
Right. That's right. But, you know, I'll tell you this. The thing that I learned from that show was how amazing George Michael was. And what I mean by that was he was
a pro.
He was so generous, Tori, because he would say things that he knew were wrong and that he knew were stupid, but he would say them to make me and Sonny and Riggins look good. And we would go, no, George, that's not it at all.
Wow.
You know, and he did it week after week after week after week. And I thought, at first I thought it was a fluke. And then I thought, well, no, he's doing this on purpose to make us look good. And it was just, it was such a lesson in teamwork. I never have forgotten how generous he was to do that for us. And it was a great show. It was the first time I did TV. First time.
Oh, so that's what really got your face.
Yeah.
In front of you. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Wow,
yeah.
That was, so the
that
first
was fun.
The first David Aldridge moment. Nice. So what convinced you to go and do it again? The money? You can be honest.
No, it's not that's the other thing is different because it's not the money this time. Local TV doesn't have the budgets they used to have, you know, so no, it's not the money. No, just, you know, J.P. Finley, who's host the show, is a very earnest guy. He works really hard. He asked me to do it, and I said, fine, uh-huh. It's fine. And I don't mind doing it. Enjoy talking with him and John Keim and Nikki Javala, who are all our four panelists, you know, who cover the team as well. So it's fun. That part.
Okay, last question. Do you have to go there and be in person?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. You go to the studio. We tape during the week. It airs on Sunday morning.
Gotcha. Ed, football fan? You've been around D.C. for a long time.
I am, but...
Not the Washington football team.
No, I've been, for most of my life, I've been a fan of the Miami Dolphins.
And Thank you so much
for your sympathy.
Yeah.
I really appreciate that. It's not... I've tried to quit, and I can't do it. I don't know what it is. I've gone to a Ravens game every year, and I feel like it would be such an easy switch for me to be a Ravens fan. And I tried... And I can't do it. It feels disingenuous and it's so stupid. Yeah, it's so, but why? Why are they my team? They've done nothing for me.
It doesn't matter. They're your team.
I get it. You're a football team fan. So
if you were a fan of theirs when you were a kid, you're going to be a fan of theirs for life.
Yeah.
I hate how that works.
This is my favorite part of Chatter and Books, at about 7 minutes in, watching. Sometimes when our featured authors come in early and they're just watching, and Sasha right now is going, what the F am I doing on this?
Talking about football and drinking. What is this?
I love that. Okay,
I've got a little room to write young adult novels. Don't know exactly, but I'm here for the ride.
Good. All right, hang in there. I promise it's going to be a lot about you. Okay, I've got a tiny bit of news and I've got two emails. Which would you guys like to do first?
It's your show, Tori.
Okay. The news is, as I might have hinted at a couple of weeks ago, I've been talking to Craig Schwab over at WTOP. And so our podcast, Chatter and Books, is now going to be on the WTOP Podcast DC. They've created a new platform. They're really trying to showcase DC talent, DC content. It's not just politics. As a matter of fact, if you look at it, it's sports, it's entertainment, it's information, it's a lot of cool things. JJ Green and Chris Kohr have a fabulous podcast, which everyone should listen to. But we're very happy about that, and we're very appreciative of WTOP. So Podcast DC, check it out. Okay, two emails. One is from our listener, David, and he sent this in after the show with Karen Tumulty about the mm-hmm. triumph of Nancy Reagan.
Yeah.
And I just have to say, guys, we tried, David, right? We tried. Mm-hmm. And Karen Tumulty is a fabulous person. Ed, I don't know if this book has come across your radar. This incredible person, Karen Tumulty, did a remarkable reporting job, 581 beautifully, phenomenally well-written research pages.
Yeah.
About Nancy Reagan. And it's like crickets.
Mm.
It's like crickets because it just, right? But anyways, so David, who follows the show, his email is sup1018@AOL.com. He was commenting on the show and he goes, that was fantastic. Thank you. And I read it going, wow, this David must have some problems. He goes on to say, he was living in DC. He said, I was in eighth grade. We were talking about the shooting of Ronald Reagan on March 31st. 1981, right, David Aldridge?
That's right.
And he goes, I was in eighth grade at the field school, which was four blocks from where President Reagan got shot. The field school used to be downtown. We had open lunch and hung out right next to the hotel. I think we were at People's. Remember People's Drugstore?
People's Drugstore, sure.
Yeah. We got back to school, and then about 30 minutes later, the shooting happened. We had to stay at school until around 7 that evening for our safety, and they came in and searched our building, bags, etc. I was just telling my nephew that whole story a few weeks ago. Thank you for everything. Every podcast is so great, David. So that's fabulous.
I thought that was such a good episode.
What did you like about it?
I would never have wanted to been that interested in a book. I mean, I read more fiction than nonfiction.
Right. So
I really probably would have been that interested in a book about Nancy Reagan. And the fact that she did such in-depth research to the point of her childhood and how her mother had essentially abandoned her when she was little.
Right.
The amount of information there just sounded so compelling. I had no idea about her relationship with her children until that podcast.
Okay.
I thought it was great.
Here's the distinction. David, tell me if you agree or disagree. Mm-hmm. So Susan Page wrote a remarkable biography about Barbara Bush.
Yes.
And what you learned is it really was about their marriage and mm-hmm. how the death of their small child when Robin was very young, 3-4 years old, had this huge impact on their marriage and their life. And then also in years later, Barbara Bush's influence on her husband as president. So you learn something about Barbara Bush you didn't know and you go, wow, that was to a good purpose. Mm-hmm. Right, David? Mm-hmm. And again, I hate to say wasted talent, but Karen is so remarkable and she researched so phenomenally, to your point, Ed. And it was, I don't know, David, what was your thought?
I mean, I think the problem, and it's not Karen's fault, it's not her issue, is that Ronald Reagan's kind of a, when I say cipher, I don't mean it in a pejorative way, but he's kind of a cipher, you know, like you kind of just, you just take from him what you want, depending on who you are.
Right.
Because nobody really knew who was this guy, you know, like the wholly created, made up, literal, you know, movie character. Who was the person? And I think that's part of the difficulty. Whereas George Bush, whatever you think of George Bush, you know what he is, who he was as a person. Yeah. And I think conversely, you have a better sense of their marriage because you know who these two people really are.
Right.
I mean, that's just my take on it.
I just hope the next time Karen Tumulty decides to spend 4.5 years of her life. Don't say that. Okay. Second, it's not an email. It's a beautiful, we can see it. I can show it up.
That is right up your alley.
It's right up my alley. And it is because, dear Ms. Clark, this is typed. Wow. Who has a typewriter anymore? I recently sent a rough watercolor rendering, much like this one, on this card to our friend Tony Kornheiser. Well, he says much like this one. It has his signature and the number 21. So I think it's much like these.
Okay.
Much like this one to our friend Tony Kornheiser. It depicts the woman to whom I plan to be related by marriage. I plan to be related by marriage in an eventing competition with her Irish sport horse. I explained to Mr. Tony how my favorite equestrian has allowed me to ride that wonderful steed and how it is like being handed the keys to a high-performance sports car. He made mention of this and explained that Tori Clark would likely understand what this reporter was writing about. So belatedly, I'm now sending Tori Clark a similar rendering. I hope you like it. Big fan of yours, etc. It gives an artist great joy when somebody appreciates his doodles. I hope you like this one. Sincerely, George Mallett. He's from Minnesota. And George, we appreciate your
doodles. Very nice.
Lovely. I think I'm pretty sure he's a journalist out there. Okay. I'm pretty sure. Okay. So David, Ed, you're a guest. You get to pick it. Do you want to do the kidney versus the story about the kidney donation first, or Hillary versus Bill?
I think there's so many opinions and thoughts and feelings about the kidney lady.
Yeah, let's do that.
I think you have to go with that.
Okay, so I'm going to barely set it up, and then Ed's going to help us, and David, you're going to help us figure this out.
Yeah.
So a woman donates a kidney.
Yes.
In real life, and she posts some stuff on social media about it. Another woman.
First mistake, but go ahead.
Look at me, social media.
Exactly.
And always, you know what? I used to know who came up with this line, but now I just completely have stolen it from my own. Ed, why do social media platforms have cute names like Instagram and Facebook and Snapchat and et cetera and Twitter?
Are you asking me or is this a
joke? I'm asking you.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. I don't know.
Because narcissism is so hard to spell. It's so great. Okay, so a woman donates a kidney, goes on social media, including with her writer group friends, and we know something about writer groups. Someone in the writer group writes a story about it. Ed, take it from there.
You know what? Honestly, you better tell the story instead of me. And I hate to defer because I like attention and I love talking, but I think I'm going to screw this up and I don't want to.
Okay, so woman donates the kidney. She goes on social media. She clearly wants attention and praise for it. And she's not getting it from the people she thinks are her closest friends and supporters in this writer's group. And then she notices that one of them has written a short story. And this other woman.
About a woman who donates a kidney.
The other woman who's a writer has had more success as a writer. And she has things published. And she has things, people writing about her writing. And she starts trading emails with her. And the way I got attracted to it was Robert Kolker in the New York Times Sunday Magazine last Sunday wrote a very long story, about 10,000 words, which is a lot, about this. And you start out reading it and you hear this woman who's donated the kidney and she seems a little pretentious and she seems a little attention seeking. And I'm kind of thinking, because I jumped to conclusions, okay, she's the bad guy. Mm-hmm. And then you keep going and she's accusing this other woman of stealing, of appropriating her story. And then you get further along and you all of a sudden, because there are legal battles, you know, first right, you know, first left and everywhere, there are legal battles, all these emails and texts and other exchanges start coming out publicly. And the person who wrote the story did indeed appropriate the story and actually, I would say, stole actual words from posts that the kidney donor gave and used them and used them literally and quoted her completely accurately, but did not attribute this to her. Mm-hmm. So, David, you're a journalist. You care about plagiarism. What do you think?
Yeah, I do. Yeah, I mean, you're right, Tori. It's not as cut and dried as you would think at first blush. My initial reaction was to think about the Social Network movie, you know,
and
based on the book and the Winklevoss twins saying that Zuckerberg stole Facebook from him and from them and him saying, look, somebody can design a chair. That doesn't mean that's the only person that can ever design a chair. Yeah. Like other people can design chairs too. And I just designed something else that was like yours, but not yours. Right.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, when you start lifting whole phrases without attribution, that's when it gets really,
right.
That's when it's a problem. It's a problem.
One of the texts or emails, I forget which one it is, I apologize, of the writer mm-hmm. actually said to some of her friends, I didn't want to use that exact line from kidney donors post, but it was too good to pass up.
Yeah, so that's where I think she crossed the line. She crossed the line. That's stealing.
Okay, Ed, whose side are you on? Kidney donor or writer?
You know, oh my God, I don't want to be on either side.
You're still Washington. You're still Washington. You're still
but Washington. No, I don't want to align with either of those. Right. I mean, I'm already a Dolphins fan. I have to, it's bad enough. But there's one thing that struck me from this, and it's a fear that I've always had writing fiction, and I bet Sasha would agree with this. It's not something I've heard a lot of writers talk about. You know, nonfiction is meticulously researched. Right. Mm-hmm. And you know where the quote, you should know where the quotes come from and right. what your sources are and
right.
And the emphasis of your writing. Fiction's meticulously imagined. And I always worry that I have lifted, that I'll come up with something really good and I'll be proud of myself. And then I'll find out later, months later, when after publication, that I've lifted an entire paragraph or something. Right. I don't think that's what happened here. I think it's a fear, though, that when I talk to my friends, that we all have, that we don't know what came out of our subconscious and worked its way into the paper, and we're going to plagiarize something. Yeah. Because most of what comes into our imagination doesn't come from us. It's influenced by something else.
Right. Okay, so one of the defenses the writer came up with was, well, what somebody posts in social media is different. It's not given the same protections as something that someone might have written in a book, in a journal, in a whatever. I mean, that to me sounds a little bit like the Zuckerberg defense. Well, just because we provide this information, we provide the platform for this information, we're not responsible for it. They don't want to be responsible for the same things that say the Washington Post are responsible for, right, Dana? Yeah.
I mean, that's, you know, that I think that's a convenient, you know, explanation, excuse, whatever you want to call it. The fact is that was a thought that someone articulated and wrote down. Now you get into intellectual property and all sorts of issues. I we're kind of in a gray area, I think, as far as I know. I could be wrong with regard to, or is that protected speech and things like that. And I would lean on the side of caution, which is, again, the thoughts of someone that are articulated under their name and written down.
Yeah.
Cannot be appropriated for someone else's use.
Right.
At least I would feel very weird about just kind of cribbing a paragraph or two or something or a post that somebody left on Facebook and then repackaging it and saying, well, I came up with this. Well, no, you actually didn't.
You read this
and then you rewrote it and you changed a couple of words.
Yeah.
So, you know,
the piece by Coker, no one should ever take time out of listening to this podcast to go read it. But the piece by Robert Coker, New York Times, was brilliant because the way it was written.
Yeah.
For the first, I don't know how many words, I'm with the writer. Just
sure.
going, oh, please, this kidney donor, please, right? But then what I saw were, David, to your point, she took the exact words from a post on Facebook or wherever it was. I thought, oh. I mean, I get obsessive about intellectual property. And I thought that was just complete theft.
Yeah, okay. I think, you know, it's like kind of alternate history books, which are very, you know, big genre, right? Yep. So you take a person named Harry S. Truman and you do something different to him than what actually happened to him. I think that's a completely different deal than taking someone's written words and, and, you know, repackaging them as your own. Those are two different things, you know?
Yeah.
Can I, can I ask a question about this to, since you both have experience in journalism, why did the New York Times write about this piece? You know, I was on that side of the fence at first, and it absolutely, you know, resonated with a lot of people. It drove a big discourse on Twitter, as surprisingly. And they, but I couldn't figure out until I saw who maybe who was associated with the group, why this even had coverage outside of a kind of small quiet thing. I mean, the one writer who appropriated had been published in the Best American Short Stories of the Year, which by itself isn't necessarily, you know, a career making thing. I couldn't quite figure out what led the New York Times to devote so much space to this.
I think it got lit up on God help us, you know, literary groups on social media. I think it just lit it up and there was a lot of it. And the Sunday New York Times, I seldom read it, most for a lot of different reasons, mostly because my husband grabs it first thing Sunday morning to do that flipping crossword puzzle. But I think they saw it so lit up in literary circles. And again, literary circles, with all due respect to the many people we have on the show, including Sasha, it kind of reminds me of academia. Never the fight's so great because the stakes are so small.
Yeah.
It reminds me of that a little bit. But I, again, I'm obsessed with intellectual property protection. So I was really down one path. And then I went, wait a minute. To David's point, those were her exact words.
Yeah.
The writer stole. Okay.
Well, it touched on so many things too, right?
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Last one. And then we'll go to Sasha. Okay. Hillary Clinton and Louise Penny, who's a big time writer, came out with A State of Terror, their new novel. And the reason I want to talk about this is because I want to read from Ron Charles' review. Ron Charles, Washington Post book critic, fabulous guy, often on the show. Ron Charles should write a book because he is a brilliant writer.
Yes.
And he wrote this piece less to review the book that Hillary Clinton and Louise Penny have written, State of Terror, which sounds like it's pretty good, pretty fun. Next time I'm in an airport, I'm sure I will pick it up. More to compare Hillary's book to the novels that Bill Clinton has written with James Patterson. And one was called, what were the two titles?
The President's Daughter. And then,
that's right. The President is Missing.
And the President is Missing. Right, 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 right.
Two things we don't care about, right? But anyways. And this reminds me of one of our favorite ongoing battles here, Ed, which is David and I deeply hope, I'm going to speak for David, that Michelle Obama's memoir does much better than Barack Obama's.
It's fine.
A much better book. David, David, have you yet read Barack Obama's?
I've read parts of both. And it is, no, she's a better writer.
Fine. I just much better writer.
The president is, he's a lawyer. He writes like a lawyer. That's how
exactly. I would. Most presidents write their memoirs very defensively. So I'm opening up for viewers. This is actually a newspaper. The only reason we still get print newspapers is because we need the plastic bags for our dogs.
Correct.
But Ron Charles wrote this long review of Hillary Clinton's book. And it was really just to compare her writing and what she does to Bill Clinton, which is spectacular. And I'm going to read this because it's so great. Another striking contrast is how differently Bill and Hillary regard the press. In his last novel, Bill laments that journalists are craven and untrustworthy. But State of Terror, Hillary's book, is predicated on the honor and hard work of reporters. Before taking on her job as Secretary of State, Ellen, one of the protagonists, ran a media empire that produced important investigations. And her son is an international journalist determined to find the truth and protect his sources. It's as though one novelist understands the importance of the free press in a democracy, and the other is still bitter that he got caught with his pants down. I mean, drop the mic, right? Ron Charles is the best. He's the best. Okay, Ed, are you, one side or the other, Hillary Clinton or Bill Clinton, which one would you rather read? If you could only read one, which one would you read?
Hillary Clinton's, because I'm very jaded. I don't know how much.
You're from
either,
D.C.
Yeah, yeah, and I'm a writer, so I'm very jaded. But I don't know how much either Hillary or Bill wrote the book, and I really admire Louise Penny's writing. With the James Patterson book, they actually, I don't know which one, but they credited a ghostwriter in the beginning. So I'm not even sure if either of them wrote that book or somebody else did, which isn't a knock. I like to think that they both had a lot of input into the book. Yeah. I'm not sure how much they sat down and went back and forth with, you know, drafts.
It sounds like from Ron's review that Hillary Clinton, at least, used it as the opportunity to create characters very similar to people she admired in life. Mm-hmm. So that's good. David, which side? There's only one
side. Oh, I would definitely read Hillary's book first. Again, it's the same problem that I have with Reagan, that I have with Bill Clinton, is that I have no idea who that person actually is.
Right.
Who are you? like, whereas I think Hillary Clinton is a fully formed human being and for some reason has become this kind of caricature cartoon people put their, you know, various prejudices and hopes and dreams into, but the actual person seems like she'd be an interesting person, and she seems like she's really smart. So yeah. I'd be very interested to see what she writes about and how.
Okay, I'm writing down Hillary wins. Okay, Hillary wins.
That's so nice to hear after.
Touche.
Sasha Payton Smith, you're still with us. Thank you so much.
Why you stayed, I have no idea.
Really, exactly.
She is drinking, so.
There you go. Nice to see you again, my friend. Full disclosure, I know Sasha. I first met Sasha and was so impressed with her via her significant other, who is a good friend of my son, Collins. But I feel like, Sasha, you and I we've moved to a new level.
Colin's not even involved at this point.
Exactly.
So Colin is going to be the best man in my upcoming wedding. So we go way back.
Other than that, he's not involved. Thank you so much for joining us. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's so exciting to be here. Thank you for having me.
Good to see you. Okay. On the show, as I think I told you, we love to get a little bit of the backstory. You're so young and adorable. You don't have much of a backstory, but we'll talk anyhow. But I was reading an interview with you, and I have to start with this. And this is a quote from Sasha. Like any teenager in the early 2000s, with a Tumblr account, with a Tumblr account, David's looking up Tumblr account, I wrote a lot of terrible poetry and hid it in folders on my parents' desktop computer. Okay, Sasha, there are so many things with which Ed and David, Claude, and I cannot relate.
I wrote terrible poetry on a floppy disk.
Yeah. Did you really?
Oh, God, yes. It's horrendous stuff that no one will ever see.
I am old. Hey, Sasha, tell us about that terrible poetry. What was it about? What were you trying to emote?
Oh, my God. Oh, God. And one, I've never been quoted to my face before. And to have that quote specifically is
loved it.
Particularly jarring. It was a lot of, I was, you know, 15, 16, 17. And it was a lot of like very bad kind of like free form prose about boys I had crushes on who did not have crushes on me back. I will say my public high school had a really great literary curriculum, actually. And we had a literary magazine, and I became the copy editor of my literary magazine. And so copies of these poems somewhere exist in like the basements of my classmates' parents' houses.
Oh, we will find those. Ed, poetry ever?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
Of course.
Every writer and, you know, like half everybody has, you know, written terrible poetry I didn't keep it a secret. I gave it to a woman at the time who could probably, you know, blackmail me now just for pride. They wanted.
Did you give it to them on paper?
I don't know. I probably gave it to them on parchment or some, you know, stupid thing like that. It was really bad.
Love it. Nice.
Yeah, you love it.
It's like Air Supplies, you know, parachutes on the cover.
Okay, Sasha, so you're doing poetry, and it's appearing in these literary journals in your high school, but you were on a biology path? I did not know that.
I was, yeah. So my undergraduate degree is in biology, and my master's degree is in public health. So
did you want to be? If you're studying biology, what do you become?
For about 6 months, I wanted to be a doctor. Quickly decided I would not make a particularly good physician. So,
what made you decide that?
I didn't have the patience for it. I'm not a talented academic. I don't think I had the thirst for research that you need to become a really great physician. My chemistry grade just wasn't that good. If we're getting down to brass tacks,
yes.
But I was very stubborn, and I liked biology. I really did love biology. So I stuck with the degree and spent kind of my undergraduate years working in labs and figuring out what I wanted to do with this biology degree that I was getting. And then late at night, I would go home and I would write. And I wanted to be a very practical sort of person. And I didn't think that writing was a very practical dream. And so I found public health, which I think kind of fit into the the intersection of both being creative and doing advocacy and doing science that I enjoyed. And then my secret writing wasn't so secret anymore.
So you and I share one thing, which is I thought I was going to be a veterinarian one day, and organic chemistry just killed me.
Yeah.
Killed me. I think we have, I think we've talked about this in the show. I took organic chemistry my first semester at NC State and got a C, and I hired a tutor and I studied harder and I got a D. It was a sign. It was a sign from God. And as I say all the time, my tutor, God bless him, would not take payment. He says, no, that was too bad. That was too sad. Okay. So biologist by day, writer by night. What made you say, because you started to spend an extraordinary amount of time on this book, The Witch Haven, which is fabulous. What made you say, that's it? And did you have to tell your family? How did they take the news? How did you make the shift?
So it was the summer after college. I was 23 years old, and I've always been a big reader, and I love young adult fantasy novels. I've always, you know, been somebody who kind of devours, you know, particularly books for young people in my spare time. And I was going through one of those like devastating end of college breakups, and I'd moved back into my childhood bedroom, and I was waiting to move away for graduate school, and I was feeling really kind of lost and unmoored. And I was kind of writing, but I had no real intention of being a novelist. I didn't think that was something that I had any right to imagine that I could one day be. And I read an interview with Victoria Aveyard, who wrote the smash hit Red Queen series. Series. And she's about my same age. She's a couple years older than me, but we're, you know, kind of around the same age. And in this interview, she said, I was sitting in my childhood bedroom the summer after college, and I thought, why don't I try to write a novel? And I think I was waiting for someone to give me permission to try. So I opened my little college MacBook Air, and I had kind of two nuggets of ideas. I had an idea for a school for witches disguised as a tuberculosis sanitarium. And I had an image of a girl standing over a man dying with a pair of scissors in his neck, which is the opening chapter of the book. And I just thought, let's try, let's see if I can do this. I am deeply stubborn. And so I kept going until it was good.
And it's very good. It's The Witch Haven. So give
us good enough to publish. Good is relative.
No, it's very, very good. It's incredibly entertaining. So I say it's murder and magic and mayhem in Manhattan. Give us the 30-second, the elevator pitch. Give us the snapshot of the plot of the story.
Yeah, so The Witch Haven is about a school for witches disguised as a tuberculosis sanitarium in 1911 New York City. It follows 17-year-old seamstress Frances Hallowell, who's reeling from the mysterious death of her brother 4 months prior. She's working late in the shop one night, and her predatory boss attempts to attack her. He ends up dead at her feet, her scissors in his neck. She can't explain how they got there. Two nurses arrive to tell her that she has tragically been diagnosed with tuberculosis. She's whisked off to this secret school for witches and begins to suspect that the magical underworld of New York City might have something to do with the death of her brother.
Nice. You've said that a few times.
I've done it a couple of times.
Okay, Ed, you're into murder and mayhem and dark things.
Yeah.
What do you think of the snapshot?
I thought it was so good. When Tori gave me the book, I was like, oh man, I don't know if I'm gonna have time. And I had no problem because it was a couple of long nights of reading and I enjoyed it a great deal. I have to say though, you set the bar for yourself for a debut writer so high because the world building in the book, I mean, two of the hardest things that I think anyways are to write about are historical fiction and magic, because you have to create, you really have to work that suspension disbelief, and you did it so smoothly. Was that the, you know, did you have plans to originally set it where you did?
So 19- when you did Yeah, I mean, thank you so much for those kind words. That's very flattering. Yeah, so 1911, really the crux of the book is, you know, I'm not the first writer to play with power as a metaphor. I wanted to examine a world in which, in what women in a world where they had very little power, what would they do with very literal power in the form of magic? And so I chose 1911 because it was kind of this strange transitory year regarding what it meant to be a woman in America. It was the year of the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. Right. Women were working outside the home in droves for the first time as the Industrial Revolution kind of swept the nation. So they had, you know, a life outside the home, but very little in the way of financial and social freedom. The suffragette movement was taking off in earnest, but it was still very much based in white women saying, give us the vote and we'll outvote the immigrants. It was still very much based in classism and racism. And I wanted to explore what literal power would mean to this girl who has very little. There's a line in the book that I think is kind of the thesis of the book that says to be a witch is to have power in a world where women have none. And so setting it in historical period, particularly 1911, was just me trying to shoehorn in the thesis I wanted to explore.
No, it's great. Talk about why New York City and your personal fascination with New York City.
Yeah, so New York City, I kind of fell backwards into. So the idea for the school for witches disguised as a tuberculosis sanitarium came directly from my own grandmother. My grandmother was a nurse, and she did her nurse's training in New York City in the 1930s. And right as she was about to graduate, they said, congratulations on your studies. You have tuberculosis. You have 6 months to live. Welcome to your new home. And they locked her in a tuberculosis sanitarium. She could see the skyline, and she sat there for 3 years. And my grandmother's sanitarium kind of always like loomed large in my brain. And New York City, I didn't ever picture it setting it somewhere else because it was really an ode to my grandmother.
But you had a little bit, tell me if I'm wrong, but based on what I was reading, Salt Lake, you're from Utah. Yep. So kind of a personal fascination with New York City. One of the great things I think I read you talking about was glitter versus glass.
Yeah, there's a God. You really read everything. I could tour. You did your research.
What I do. This is what I do.
I wrote a piece for a blog where I said something along the lines of like, "Is it glitter on the sidewalk or broken glass?" Like with New York.
That's a great line about New York City. Like, that is David and write that one down. That is a great one to steal about New York City.
Go you ahead. Can have it. Yeah.
This isn't going to be a kidney thing, right? I can use that.
You guys, thank God you take me off mute for that kidney thing. You'd have me on here for like 4 hours. So I grew up kind of in isolation in the mountains of Utah. And I had my cousin and her wife live in New York City, and I'd get to go every couple of years. Uh-huh. And I had this real fascination with this city, and it's, you know, kind of a cliche. I felt like I could be somebody else, and you could be whoever you wanted to be in New York City. And it felt like a completely other world from, you know, my own hometown. And, you know, when you're playing with fantasy, it was nice. Really appealing.
Okay. Forget fantasy. Tell us about what is real in Frances. And by that, I mean, Frances, 17-year-old, the seamstress, she finds she has magic at this incredibly important time. How much of describe Frances a little bit, and how much of her is you?
Yeah, so Frances is a 17-year-old seamstress. Her mother is in an asylum, and her brother is dead, and she's sad. God, she's just sad. And I wrote Frances, I think, for 17-year-old me, who had much fewer reasons to be sad. My life was pretty good and untraumatic. But the biggest emotion that I remember from being 17 was just being sad and being pissed off. And I tried to imbue Frances with some of that just like anger, that like, you know, just like big cloud of feeling. It felt like my emotions were bottomless when I was 17. And I think that's one of the fun things about writing young adult novels, is you get to explore that part of yourself again. So Frances isn't me, but a lot of her is.
We've tried. You probably are the first, I think, out of over 100 shows, Sasha, I think you're the first where we've had somebody who really has done a young adult novel. Again, I loved it. So that tells you something about my emotional immaturity. But when I was 17, and David and Ed, I want you to tell me, what was your primary feeling when you were 17? I promise you, when I think back to when I was 17, it's a haze because I drank too much beer. But my life was wandering down the street to school occasionally, sitting on the benches. And I really can't tell you about Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. But by Thursday, the primary thought was, where's the party Friday night? I mean, that was it. And that was as complicated as my life got. And my mood, I didn't have these, you know, I didn't have the God, I love this guy or I hate this or whatever. I just had the, wow, where's the party Friday night? But David, 17-year-old, what was the primary feeling? If we were writing about, if Sasha was writing about 17-year-old David Aldridge, what would she be writing about?
Well, first, I have to congratulate Sasha because she decided to write to deal with her 17-year-old angst. I decided to go into therapy. So that's a win for you. Oh, my God. You know, the show's not long enough to deal with 17-year-old me. It's just a melange of, oh, God, of inadequacies of all kinds. Whatever subject matter you have, would you put on the table? I was inadequate at it. So
okay.
The sense that I could not and would not and would never be able to really accomplish much of anything because I couldn't really do anything. And that started with this monumentally futile pursuit of young women and just being horrendously bad at it.
Yeah.
And seeing guys that just look like they came right out of GQ and they got these beautiful girlfriends. And you know, even at 17, you know, well, that's not gonna last, but you're still envious, you know? And yeah. So my complete failure as a human being was the crux of 17-year-old me.
Okay, Ed, quickly, you as a 17-year-old.
Same thing, you know, I mean, for different reasons. I'm mixed. I'm half white, half Latino, and the Latino kids never really accepted me. The white kids never really accepted me. So I just, you know, threw myself at girls. And a lot of it was probably thinking to myself, you know, why did I write that poem on parchment and give it to that girl? What a mistake. You know, she's going to blackmail me later in life. And I was really into professional wrestling. So those were pretty complex stuff, Tori.
Awesome. Okay, Sasha, back to you and the fabulous book, The Witch Haven. On this, I get to hold it up all the time. It's beautiful cover, by the way. Historical fiction. You did a lot of research. And one of the things, to Ed's point, I'm not the be all end all literary critic, but unlike some other first time novels, this one is so beautifully written and it's so, every word has a meaning, every sentence has a purpose. There's not a lot of excess, which I find so impressive, but you managed to put some things in there and in their appropriate context. So you talk about the suffragettes, but that's kind of over there. You talk about Native Americans and the cultural assimilation schools. Can you talk a little bit about the research you did for this book, or were these just things you knew and you knew you wanted to include?
I mean, I knew kind of nuggets of those things and I knew I wanted to include as I wrote about this world. But no, I did a lot of research, particularly around Lena, who was one of the main characters who spent time.
Fabulous.
The Thomas School, which is a real school that existed, I think, well into the 1940s. And it was a cultural assimilation school. And I wrote about this because I didn't know about this. I grew up in the West. I have Native American friends and family members. And this part of American history has just been so brushed under the rug. But these cultural assimilation schools were a form of genocide. The concept was we will take away Native children from their parents and we will rid them of their language and their culture. And then their culture will die. And we did our jobs. And there were dozens of these schools across the United States. The United States has never apologized or acknowledged or made reparations for their existence. They existed well into the 1950s. And they're getting a lot of coverage now in Canada.
In Canada, yeah.
Canada stole the idea from the US. It was us first. It is not a Canadian problem. It's a North American problem. That was a story that is so important and so sensitive and so fundamentally not mine to tell that I did so much research. Everything Lena says is backed up by a firsthand historical document that I found. Lena's first name and last name were names from census records that I found from Seneca girls who were 17 in 1911. Like, I telling this story correctly was so important to me. And the suffragette movement was similar. I think that, you know, we're taught, especially, you know, like I'm a white girl who grew up in the 90s and early 2000s. I was given like cute picture books about the suffragettes and like rah, 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 women's rights.
Cute outfits with armbands, puppy sleeves and armbands. That was it. There was always one picture. It was usually just a small part of a page. Right?
Yep. It was like, and then they marched and they were tough and we got the right to vote. that's not the story at all. And so a lot of this was like correcting my own education and my own upbringing. And if I'm going to write a book about power, you know, these were things I had to touch on. And I, you know, this is a book that's written as the first person perspective from the perspective of a 17-year-old white girl. And I'm not the right person to write a book about racism in 1911, but I think it would have been really disingenuous for me to write a book that took place in 1911 and was like, wasn't everything fun and shiny and the dresses were cool.
How do you, and Ed, I'd love to hear your opinion on this. How do you balance? So David writes about things that are happening and they're real and they're factual, and he brings a lot of context to it, of course, but that's different. You have to balance fantasy with reality. How did you do that in this context? And Ed, I'd love to hear what you think about that as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's a balancing act, because I want to write a book that is kind of fundamentally sparkly and entertaining. And Turner, hearing that you stayed up at night reading it makes me so happy, because that's what I wrote the book to do. But yeah, I didn't want to write about a world that, you know, fundamentally didn't exist. I chose to set this book in 1911 New York, and I have to deal with what that means. So yeah, I think setting it in a first person perspective, we see things from Francis's point of view, so it's narrow. I think that helps things move at a fairly fast clip, because I'm aware that I'm writing for people who live in 2021, and they'll pick up on things even if Frank doesn't, which was meant to be intentional. But yeah, I mean, it's a balancing act. It's tough. It's one of the things I think I spent the most time thinking about when it came to writing.
Okay. Ed, have you found yourself sometimes saying, okay, I got to pull back a little? It's not historical fiction, but how crazy can I get here versus I got to keep this more real?
Yeah, you know, for me, the topic that I researched extensively for my first book and then has kept reappearing as a theme has been human trafficking, or sex trafficking in particular. And, you know, I'm not, like Sasha said, there's a lot of reasons I'm not the person to write that story, but it's a story that compels me. Additionally, every book I've written, the Donner Penn had... they've had two perspectives, and a perspective has always been a woman. And I have to really make sure that I get that right, that I don't make that character a masculine version of a woman. You know, it really has. So there's my balancing act falls with that, with trying to be like Sasha said, trying to be authentic to the characters and also empathetic to the situation that they're in.
Nice. Okay, Sasha, we got to do 60 seconds more with you, but I don't want to give anything away. I don't want to give any spoilers. The Witch Haven is fabulous. And there's romance in it as well. And I was reading it and going, okay, is that Charles? I happen to know Sasha's significant other. It's like, is that Charles? With that hair, could be Charles. But is there a sequel? Is there a follow-up to The Witch Haven? Can you tell us? Are you allowed to tell us?
There is, yes. So there's a sequel. I just turned in a draft. There's a beginning, a middle, and an end. So it should be coming out about a year from now. Follows the same cast of characters. I get to, you know, take them out of magical New York. We get to see more of the magical world. We get to see more of their relationships with each other. And Tori, you just became Charles's favorite person. So I don't speak a lot about him publicly, and this is not an issue at all, but he's always like, reveal me on Instagram. And I'm like, no, it's for work. Totally coincidentally bears a lot of resemblances to Oliver, who's one of the romantic interests in the book. And I wrote Oliver before I met Charles. And I tell people that because I'm like, I swear I didn't write my fiance into this book. I just accidentally manifested him.
this is spectacular material for someone at your upcoming wedding. Spectacular material, which I will be happy to provide at a certain price. Happy surprise. Okay, so biology and the medical profession's loss is the literary world's gain. So Sasha, I'm so glad you gave up on biology. Thank God it was chemistry.
That is biology. I'm a better writer.
Okay, I'm not sure why the dogs are barking. Okay, we got a little bit of housekeeping here. Again, thank you to WTOP for putting us on Podcast DC. We encourage everybody to download it there, whatever you do. And download us, follow us, sign up for Patreon. You do get some great stuff put together by the incredibly talented Claude Jennings. Lots of interaction there. We are back next week with Donnie Walton. Where's Donnie's book? Donnie Walton, who I've traded emails with. I'm already in love with this person. It's called The Final Revival of Opal and Nev. It's supposed to be great. Jason Reynolds has raved about it. And I'm thinking if we get Donnie Walton on and she loves it, then we can get Jason Reynolds on. So we'll be back next week with that. Sasha, thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations on the book, everything going forward.
Congratulations.
Ed, David, thank you so much. Claude, thank you. Everybody for listening, for watching. Thank you so much. Stay well, and we'll see you next week.